Good morning. Here's the latest news of the world. At this same time every morning over many of these stations, we bring you direct news reports from abroad. For the news in Great Britain, we take you now to London.
This is Robert St. John in London. The Russians continue to sweep ahead after their greatest territorial advance of the whole war. But from the British fronts, the news is not good today. Our information here is that the British continue their withdrawal in Malaya. The threat to Australia grows even greater. The Australian government has decided on another appeal to Churchill and Roosevelt for a flood of planes, tanks, and guns. And the last word we had from Libya was that Nazi tank columns are putting on the biggest offensive they can manage, a desperate attempt to wrest the initiative from the British. The Admiralty here in London gives us one bright piece of news. A British warship has destroyed a Jap submarine and taken some of the crew prisoner. A London paper has just come out with a headline which says, U.S. will not fail. Then it goes on to say that Britain looks to America to straighten out that Pacific mess. The paper says America still hasn't gone into action with her full strength, but that we are well aware of the gravity of the situation, and we know it's up to America over in the Far East to repel all attacks and eventually carry the war back into enemy territory while the British handle things in this part of the world. Sir Stafford Cripps is back in London. When he left here for Moscow 18 months ago, he had a tough job on his hands. Ambassador to Russia, which was then hooked up with the Axis. But he went with sympathy and understanding for the Russians and admiration for Stalin. In those 18 months, great things have happened. And Sir Stafford Cripps has had much to do with shaping those events. Without question, he's proved to be Britain's greatest diplomat of this age. And now he's home, a private citizen again. His future work still not cut out for him. I've just spent an hour with him listening to what he's had to say about how Russia has done it and what's likely to happen in the future. He's a wiry, dynamic little man. He leans forward intently when he talks to you. And here are some of the things he said today. Stalin has proved to be one of the greatest military strategists of all times. He personally is responsible for the brilliant campaign the Russians have put on. He remained an unseen power behind the scenes until Moscow was threatened. Then he sent his brain trust off to Kuibyshev, and he took complete charge himself. He stayed behind in the capital, and he faced the same risks and dangers his people were facing. That won him the undying admiration and love of the Russian people. One of the secrets of the Russian military success, according to Sir Stafford, has been the use of young officers. Mere boys in their 30s have been made full generals, and they've done a good job. Russia now has 9 million men under arms, with enough equipment for all of them. The Russian army this coming spring will be at least twice as strong as it was when the first Nazi attack was made last June. The morale of the Russian people is higher right now than it has ever been. Every single person in that vast nation has demonstrated an almost unbelievable loyalty to the cause. To appreciate what this means, you must visualize conditions in Russia today. Take Moscow, for example. It's 30 or 40 degrees below zero. Nearly every pane of glass in the city has been broken. There is little, if any, wood for stoves. A quarter of all the central heating apparatus in the city has broken down. Food is scarce. The people have suffered every conceivable hardship. And yet their hatred of the Nazis is so great that they fight on, suffer on, without complaint. As for the future, the Russians expect to continue hammering away at the Nazis until spring. Then they anticipate a new Nazi offensive, with Hitler throwing everything he's got into the last desperate battle. But by autumn, the Russians fully expect they will have finished off the men of Hitler. I asked Sir Stafford what the Russian attitude toward America was. He said their greatest feeling is one of intense admiration for us as an industrial nation. And of course, they're expecting great material help from us in meeting that Nazi offensive in the spring. And there, said Sir Stafford, is the whole answer to how long the war is going to last. It all depends on how much help we can get to those Russian allies of ours. And now, this is Robert St. John returning you to New York.
And before we switch abroad again, here's a dispatch received in New York from Rome. The Italian High Command claims the British have been forced to retreat east of Agadabia. The fascists say strong British forces have been pushed back by the Axis counterattack. The withdrawal from Agadabia was announced yesterday by the British. In addition to the continuing attack in Libya, the Italian High Command declares that Malta is being pounded day and night. The fascists say raids on the British island base in the Mediterranean have been pressed home despite desperate attempts by British fighter planes to bar the way. And now let's turn to the Pacific front. For this report, we take you across the nation to the newsroom in San Francisco.
And from the city by the Golden Gate, where it's now just a few minutes after 5 a.m., we take you across the Pacific for a direct report from the Netherlands East Indies.
This is Sidney Albright speaking in Batavia. The time is 8:36 on Saturday evening. In the last 24 hours, there was some activity in the outer provinces. But according to today's communique, the only actions worth mentioning were air raids on Samarinda, which was bombed, and machine guns, and Ternate, where only one bomb was dropped. During the attack on Samarinda, one man and one woman were killed. One woman was seriously wounded, and two children were slightly wounded. The communique concludes by saying, slight damage was caused by the attack on Ternate, which was carried out by one aircraft, but there were no casualties. An eyewitness account was given of the fighting in Tarakan by two men of the Indies Army who escaped in a native boat to the mainland of Borneo after the island had fallen. On January 10th, the Japanese fleet appeared off southeast Tarakan about 15 miles out to sea and consisted of six cruisers and six destroyers, escorting 22 transport ships. A start was immediately made with the destruction of the oil wells and installations. By Sunday morning, everything had been destroyed according to plan. The whole of the night, heavy explosions shook the island. Appalling fires raged. Heavy clouds of smoke rolled out to the sea. At daybreak, on Sunday the 11th, the island was a seething hell. Oil was burning on the water. In a few hours, the work of years went up in flames. At 8 o'clock, landing sloops approached the shore, five at a time, containing 30 to 50 men. Rifle and machine gun fire swept the water, inflicting heavy losses on the Japanese, particularly where the landing troops had to wade through water and mud. According to a prearranged plan, the troops stationed near Amau had to retreat after fighting a delaying action. The Japanese then advanced very quickly to the center of the island, where the East Front barred their way. But new troops were hurled into the battle. The Dutch fought the Japanese back about 1,000 meters, and at 8 o'clock in the evening, an unbroken line had been established. Although the line was unbroken, it was a thin one without depth or without reserve. The terrain over which the battle was raging was lit up by the flames of the burning oil wells. During the night, the Japanese brought up large columns of reinforcements. About midnight, Dutch machine guns and artillery put up a tremendous barrage, causing severe losses to the enemy. But no matter how great the Japanese losses, reinforcements continued to arrive. Wave after wave of fresh troops finally succeeded in breaking through the Dutch lines and penetrated the town, where fighting went on in the streets. The defending troops were forced to retreat, and 30 men reached a point south of the town where they were joined by other small groups, which were also out of contact with the central command. Realizing that it was useless to offer further resistance, several non-commissioned officers with a number of ARP volunteers located a small boat with an outboard motor, which enabled them to find safety on a nearby island. They were the first to escape, But later, they were followed by others who managed to reach safety even 3 days after the Japanese occupation of Peloton. I now return you to San Francisco.
That was Batavia. Now we switch you to the newsroom in New York.
Next, the news of doings of our own government, reported by Earl Godwin from the newsroom in Washington.
Good morning, folks. You know those orders about what you can't have or not going to get, the government gets out through the new War Production Office, make headlines and lots of news, but what will be the State of the Union when they really take effect? You know, I told you a week, 10 days ago, but that the rubber crisis would take the rubber from the girlies' girdles. That comes true, and out comes the order. No more rubber, crude rubber, to be given over to the manufacture of a score of gadgets, including girdles, golf balls, garden hose, and the like, after February 1st. That doesn't mean you can't buy them if they're there, but the manufacturers won't get any more rubber for that, those purposes. If they can get any second-hand or reclaimed rubber, that's all right. Also, there's a crackdown on the manufacture for private use of radio receiving sets until after the Army gets $2 billion worth for its own war use. In this age of Social Security and automatic arrangements for life incomes, it's interesting to note that the President has upon his desk now for signature or veto that bill extending Social Security benefits, which includes the Social Security also, to congressmen for the first time. Under this bill, congressmen can arrange for federal pensions from the time they retire from Congress, either by the will of the people or their own desire to bask in the sun of their declining years, by the payment of small sums, the same as anybody else. Those excluded from this federal pension privilege are those who have served less than 5 years in Congress. And that's only a few right now. But the premiums they pay would entitle congressmen to pensions for life ranging from $58 a month to $348 a month, dependent on their length of service. And it's the size of those pensions that attracts attention. They are, I believe, in excess of the regularly scheduled pensions for us laymen in the Social Security range, and that runs around from $42 to $85 a month. However, the congressional pension is voluntary. Congressmen do not have to enter into the scheme. But federal pensions have been the regular thing for all government employees in the civil service for nearly 25 years. That is a part of the pay system. A regular, small slice of government employees' pay is taken each month, and it adds up to a well-founded, perfect insurance fund to which the government makes regular contribution month to month, and on reaching the retirement age, the government employee lays back and enjoys life with an income for life. In contrast to this security, which is guaranteed by the United States Treasury, and if you can find any better guarantee than that, I'd like to see it, two or three employee organizations in Washington are continuously crying out against what they claim is the harsh and inadequate treatment for government employees who start in work at $1,260 or $1,440 a year, have a guaranteed annual leave with pay and a good long stretch of sick leave, can't be discharged except for real and deep cause, and who are covered by the thick blanket of civil service which now removes all politics from government work, so they say. Actual reports of American planes in actual fighting show the American plane to be as good or better than the enemy. This comes in testimony General Arnold, head of the Air Corps, gave a congressional committee, which was writing up the $12.5 billion airplane appropriation bill, which the House passed in 3 hours yesterday afternoon after a very interesting debate and a roll call vote with 309 members voting for the bill and nobody voting against it. The facts about the American airplane, as reported by soldiers, seem to deny the gloomy and pessimistic charges of the Senate's Truman Report on the same subject, which a few days ago decried and derided American airplanes and production. And that's all from Washington at this time.
And that's the news at home and abroad. You have heard a report from London by Robert St. John, From Batavia, Java, by Sidney Albright, and from Washington by Earl Godwin. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This is the Red Network of the National Broadcasting Company.
This week of war. Tonight, the United States marks the end of the seventh week since the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. This week again has brought good news and grave news for the United Nations. The National Broadcasting Company presents four expert commentators who will discuss these developments. Earl Godwin, who will report on the news in this country. Robert St. John, who will review the picture as seen in Britain. William Hillman, who will analyze European developments. And Upton Close, who will discuss the Far Eastern scene. First, Earl Godwin.
And good evening, folks. Just as a matter of spot news, the Navy Department announces a fleet of United States destroyers have made a successful night attack on an enemy convoy between Borneo and Celebes. The Navy says that three large Japanese ships were either sunk or damaged, and that heavy damage was inflicted on other vessels. But as a matter of review, here in Washington, the capital of the USA, head office of the arsenal of the United Nations, we move right on into the gigantic proportions of the shape of things to come as the war machine begins to gather speed and the grim facts seem to emerge showing that victory for the United Nations depends on the United States. It is certainly a different fact we are permitted to grasp. If we have comprehension enough for that, each one of us, from those assumptions we childishly displayed in the days when we imagined that the young men who would be selected to go to camp for training would come home in a year or so and go back to work. The mail from the rest of the country to Washington is unbelievable in extent. The mail to Congress exceeds anything experienced so far, even in those harassed and desperate WPA and PWA days when everybody back home wanted a job or a chance. Today, every congressman is snowed under again with even more mail than ever. It would appear that everybody wants to get into the Army or the Navy or to get out or to get business. I imagine that every congressman has a pack of lawyers who want to get into the government or into the Army. The Judge Advocate General of the Army has 15,000 applications from lawyers who want commissions. Apparently, the Navy is also assailed. Senator Walsh of Massachusetts, chairman of the Naval Affairs Committee, wants to investigate what he believes to be an undue number of commissions being granted. Oddly enough, his junior on the House side, Representative John McCormick of Boston, Massachusetts, majority leader, says that this time there's less political influence shown in getting Army-Navy commissions than in World War No. 1, when, as McCormick says, each congressman had his own Army and Navy. The Selective Service accounts for considerable of that difference. The dislocation of the motor industry alone when the work shuts down in a few days, February 1st, and the factories begin to retool themselves for that all-out production of the airplanes we need to fill the President's prescription of 185,000 of these overpowering weapons would be one gigantic economic earthquake by itself. The men in that industry, hundreds of thousands, would be out of work, broke, jobless, would be wandering hither and yon, picking up what they could get here and there. And when the shops reopened, where would these men be? Somewhere else. The whole industrial population for that big job could not be reassembled again in months. And so the government here plans a special Social Security deal to cover these men. $300 million is ticketed to be dealt out in special security amounts and accounts. 60% of what those men's wages were, at maximum $24 a week for that limited time, to which will be added special pay for a training course to fit these men for the new jobs of turning out warplanes by the thousand, the greatest mass production job of its kind ever considered by the human race. That $300 million, by the way, is not yet appropriated, but that's merely because they haven't had time to turn to small special matters on Capitol Hill. Why, they turned out 40 times that amount in less than 3 hours in the House yesterday afternoon before 3 o'clock, when they had up the $12 billion appropriation bill, okaying the spending of just that amount of money as a part merely for 33,000 planes. And that's just a bit of the President's ticket of 185,000. Money seems to be the cheapest and the most easily thing you can have here. So much so that a scared special economy committee of prominent citizens throughout the country organizes, hires a press agent, gets a mimeograph, and begins to issue warnings and warnings and warnings against spending. So what? We find Donald Nelson, the mail order catalog marvel, making headway and friends. He scraps the cumbersome OPM and puts whole dominions and dukedoms of war production into the hands of individual sub-czars, just a few of them. And of course, he starts off like a new broom, sweeping clean, letting everyone know there's nothing magic about what he wants, just a clear field and plenty of speed. If anyone gets in the way of speed, it'll be just too bad, says Nelson. But everything everywhere around here isn't as simple as that seems to be. In the minds of the public, there must be some confusion on sugar, just as we have been told that the stock of American sugar was okay. Federal agencies and agents told housewives from time to time there'd be plenty of sugar. Suddenly, a blast from the Department of Agriculture warns us that ere the end of this year, sugar, fat, oil would be down to the bottom of the barrel. And about the same moment, the Department of Commerce announced it had bought all the Cuban sugar crop instead of half as usual, and that would be more than the Philippine and Cuban sugar crop combined, and it's all excitement and confusion in that direction. Tonight, several of the Latin American countries have broken relations with the Axis or are preparing to do so, but Washington is disappointed because the American nations do not seem to be a solid bloc committed to take a united stand against the Axis. Argentina and Chile went into the conference determined not to allow themselves to make a complete break, and they come out that way. Undoubtedly, the most important overall matter pending is the price control bill. That's the one-man power of the most drastic and immediate kind to control inflation. It is in contrast with the board's commissions and coordinators, which have dotted Washington's page of war preparations so far. The price control bill, still hanging between Senate and House, is aimed at preventing outrageous price advances and dangerous inflation, which comes from wartime prices and could end in a collapse of mammoth size and unending destruction. In agriculture, in this price control bill are the four ceilings which the farmers all want, and on Monday we will probably see the end of the discussion. And that's all from Washington at this time, and now let's hear from Robert St. John, who speaks from London.
This is London. It hasn't been a very cheerful week for the British. Things have continued to go badly in Malaya, in fact, all over the Far East. Australia feels herself threatened. Twice this week, urgent pleas for aid have reached London from Sydney. Australia says, in effect, this is no sideshow out here. We must have help. This week, the supply line to that valiant Chinese army was threatened. And down in the desert sands of Libya, Rommel's men are on the march again. Here in England, everyone realizes that these are mighty serious days. To be sure, the Nazis are still being hammered by the Russians. But that's small comfort. It gets monotonous for British newspaper readers to see big headlines every day about Russian victories and little headlines about British retirements to better fortified positions. The public here clamors for action, or at least for some explanation of why we can't have action. One editor just today loudly denounced what he called word-of-mouth warriors. His opinions seem to represent what a lot of people are thinking these days. He says, these word-of-mouth warriors imagine that a string of comforting phrases is sufficient defense against tanks and bombers. They use words as a substitute for acts. This is the hour for action. This is no time for debating society dialectics. Out with the men who believe you can tackle an enemy in war as though he were an election opponent. Well, another editor with a flair for metaphor puts it this way. Down in the bowels of the ship, the stokers are stoking and the engineers are engineering. But up on the bridge, the first mate is arguing with the boatswain. The third officer is squabbling with the ship's doctor, and the helmsman is at the throat of the radio operator.
The dazed passengers on the lurching ship are more than ever alarmed. Well, but don't you think for a minute that all this grousing indicates any weakening of British resolve to fight to the death against Hitler and all his Axis gangsters. Quite the contrary. I've just come back from a week's tour of England. I've been talking to miners, munition workers, mill hands, all kinds of people. And I think I know how they feel. They want action. They want to get this blooming war over with. They know they're in for death and suffering sometime, but let's get on with it. That's their attitude. They'd rather go hungry, really hungry, for a few months now than to worry along with the generous rations they're getting for a couple of years longer. They'd far rather that all the ships were used to bring planes and guns now, if it would mean winding up this war any sooner. They want to know why a minister of production hasn't yet been appointed to get the maximum out of Britain's factories and workshops. They have no patience with the fear of some industrial leaders that the appointment of such a czar of industry might be embarrassing to big business after the war, that it might lead to permanent government control. The people here are still 100% behind Winston Churchill. He's still the man of the hour, the national idol. But a lot of people want him to clean house, reorganize his government, get rid of people responsible for delays, for military blunders. Next week, Churchill will probably face Parliament. The prediction is that he will use his personal popularity to shield the rest of his government. My hunch is that he's holding up his speech to Parliament until he can make some sensational announcement, an announcement which will steal the headlines right away from his critics, an announcement that will make people forget their grousing for a while. Now, many people can't understand why the British haven't sent every spare man and plane down to clean up Libya. Others realize that the very size of the far-flung British Empire is a handicap in this moment of crisis. So many fronts, and you can't send all your fire engines to one fire. Then there are others, and I am among them, who have a hunch that there is an Allied master plan, that the reason clouds of British bombers are not over Europe every night now is because they're being saved for a really big blow. Now, how about everyday life here on this island fortress, which may soon be in the spotlight itself? Well, this week up in a provincial town, I saw a night watchman at a radio station working away for hours with a razor blade, cutting safety matches in half so they'd last longer. He does it for the whole staff. Here in London this week, hot water bottles disappeared from the market because of the scarcity of rubber. But the newspapers give us a lot of advice about how to keep warm anyway. Dig out the old-fashioned warming pans. Heat up a few bricks. Use a bag of warm salt. This week, a British Earl was fined $300 for eating too many eggs. The law says one egg per person per month. But this titled Englishman had his own hens, and in 1 week, he kept 144 eggs. Well, now those eggs have cost him more than $2 apiece. The hero of the week is a British pilot whose plane was set afire by the enemy over Libya. Then he was wounded in both feet by Nazi cannon fire. He was just about to bail out when a German plane flew by. So he climbed back into his seat, went after the plane, and finally shot it down. Then he did bail out of his burning ship. The most curious ceremony of the week took place in Windsor Castle. First, let me explain that years ago, the Emperor of Japan was made a Knight of the Order of the Garter, the highest honor in England can bestow on a man. The rules provide that if ever a member disgraces himself, his name is struck from the rolls and his banner is removed from the chapel of Windsor Castle. Well, today, with traditional ceremony, they took the Emperor of Japan's banner down. They stored it away in a basement vault alongside the banners of Kaiser Wilhelm, King Victor Emmanuel, and a few other knights who are also in disgrace. The week's biggest bit of irony was a little experience at a British seaport. For hours, I watched ships coming in with food from America. For hours, I looked at charts showing the vast quantities of foodstuff on hand today in Britain. And then we had tea in the Ministry of Food Office. But tea without sugar, because the food people themselves had used up their week's ration of sugar on previous visitors. This week's prize for nonchalance ought to go to several hundred school children in the vicinity of Dover. For 4 hours one day this week, German artillery blasted away from across the channel. Heavy shells landed every 10 or 20 minutes. Yet those little children in their school shelters went right on playing games and singing their favorite song. That song that goes, "There'll always be an England." And now, back to the capital of the United States for a discussion of events in Europe by William Hillman.
Hamlet would make a poor strategist. This seventh week of the war for the globe threatened to make Hamlets of the Allied strategist. Is it to be Europe and the destruction of Hitler, or is it to be the South Pacific and the stopping of the Japanese? That is the question which vexed and is still vexing Allied leaders. Never in history has there been so far-flung a war as we are fighting today. This is the kind of statement the professors like to make. But you can't begin to appreciate the strategic problem facing the United Nations until you sum up, in simple terms, two central facts. First, Japan is delivering a major blow at a vital area in the Far East, at a time when Hitler is still strongly entrenched in Europe and likely to hit out again in the spring. Second, at this stage of the war, the amount of materials and men at the disposal of the United Nations is limited. Both materials and armed manpower will grow with time. But the enemy is making haste to deliver decisive blows before the strength of the United Nations grows. Australia, which has furnished heroic men to fight on many European and African fronts, wants major attention concentrated. If East is lost, then the war in Europe will be lost. The Australians say the Japanese will then help their Axis partners in the West with their navy and the booty of resources gained. There is much to be said for the Australian argument. On the other hand, there is a strong belief here and in Britain that the major front is Europe. The principal enemy is Hitler. Let's look at this argument. What cannot be denied is that Germany is the strongest of the Axis partners. Now, Germany is closest to the three most important of the United Nations, Great Britain, Russia, and the United States. Germany dominates the continent, the only battlefield on which Hitler can be defeated. Now, to divert too heavily from the growing strength of Britain, Russia, and the United States to fight the Japanese will make it easier for Hitler to hit at Russia, Britain, and then the United States. And there is this to be remembered at this time. Wishful thinking and the Russian success in the last 2 months have not vitally weakened Hitler's still powerful military machine. Russia is the key and the problem of the whole Allied strategy. Russia today possesses the greatest army opposed to Hitler. It is the first army that made the Nazis retreat. Until the campaign in Russia, the Nazi troops had never known what it is to go backwards. The news from Russia today continues to tell of German retreats. The Red Army has compelled the Germans to abandon the Valdai Hills in the north. As long as the Nazis held the Valdai Hills, they menaced Moscow. The Nazis are still falling back onto a winter line. The winter line seems to be a very fluid line. But this week has made four things clearer. First, the Nazi retreat is not a rout. The Russians threatened several times to close in on large bodies of German troops. These Nazi troops eluded the trap. Second, the Nazis are now approaching a point where within a short time they will be close to railroad supply lines at their rear, shortening the hauls of men and materials into Russian territory. The Germans still maintain around 90% of the territory they have originally overrun. Third, the Russians must drive the Germans out of the Donets Basin and from the Crimea to be in a position to meet the expected Nazi spring drive. The Germans are holding on determinedly to the Crimea. Fourth, The Russians need considerable strengthening in materials to be able to meet the expected Nazi spring drive. Listen to what Sir Stafford Cripps, former British ambassador to Russia, just returned from Moscow, has to say. A tremendous Allied effort will be necessary to sustain the Russians against the prospective German offensive in the spring. In fact, the whole Allied war strategy must make Russia its principal concern. Supplies must be sent in ever-increasing stream. But herewith, our Hamlets are presented with their real dilemma. If the Japanese clean up and dominate the Pacific, will Nippon then attack Russia in the Far East? If Japan tackles Russian Siberia, the burden of wars on two fronts will be a serious one for Russia. Furthermore, if Japan sweeps the South Pacific, the Indian Ocean will be open to the Tokyo marauders. This would change the picture in the Near East and again affect Russia. For supplies must go to Russia partially through Persia, and Persia is reachable from the Indian Ocean by Japanese submarines and naval vessels if the South Pacific is lost by the Allies. Shall it be Europe or shall it be the South Pacific? And now here is Upton Close, who will speak to you from the San Francisco newsroom.
Well, Bill Hillman says, shall it be the South Pacific? The first feature of the seventh week of the Pacific War is the beginning of Japan's execution of a plan indicated for years of attacking the undefended coast of Australia and outlying islands, striking from the new bases that Japan has on mandated islands which he took from the League of Nations. The second feature has been the capable resistance of General MacArthur and his Filipino co-generals on Bataan Peninsula. It is believed that the Japanese now have 200,000 men, including 10,000 motorized troops on Luzon Island. To hold up an army as large as this under one of the shrewdest Japanese generals, General Hama, is indeed a feat worthy of a MacArthur and his few thousand brave fighters. The third feature of the seventh week of war has been the slowing up of the Japanese push upon Singapore. The encouraging feature of the slow up is that it has been accomplished by air force. Last night and this morning, Singapore seems to have been virtually without serious bombing. And we can only imagine what that must mean to people in a city which has suffered casualties mounting to thousands within a single night. It all depends upon air force. Indications throughout the entire West Pacific area are that the scales are tipping back, and the terrible unbalance in which we were caught 7 weeks ago tomorrow is approaching an equilibrium fateful to our enemies. The fourth feature of the seventh week of war is found on the Burma-Siamese sector north of the Malay Peninsula. Here the Japanese, accompanied by some Siamese infantry, deployed over the deep mountain ranges separating Thailand from Burma and went deep into Burma, in fact, right up to the Gulf opposite Rangoon itself. But today, we have the confirmation of a glorious air victory over the paddy fields near Rangoon. 7 twin-engine bombers and 4 Japanese fighter planes knocked down without a single bomb falling upon Rangoon itself, making a bag of 32 planes in 2 days, a rate of loss which the Japanese Air Force is far from being capable of sustaining. It isn't comfortable, of course, to have a Japanese airport under the shadow of the pagoda at Mool Mine, where Kipling's English soldier found his Burmese maiden dressed in a pink chemise, smoking a long cheroot and kissing a bloomin' idol's toe. Still, if the Japanese can be knocked out of the air as fast as they appear over Rangoon, only a half hour out from there, we have very concrete proof of what is necessary and all that is necessary to stop the Japanese advance. Now for a little anticipation of what the eighth week of war, beginning tomorrow, may bring on each of the 5 active sectors of this huge battlefront. First, the easternmost sector, the tail end of New Guinea and the islands lying off of it, and the east coast of Australia. This east coast of Australia is about as important from a standpoint of population, industry, and strategy as the east coast of America was up to the time of our Civil War. It is as if an enemy had landed on Newfoundland and were threatening to cross over to Nova Scotia and establish air bases for bombing our centers of industry and population between Boston and Baltimore, except that in the case of Australia, those centers are 400 miles further down the coast, where Georgia and Florida would lie with us. And in the case of Australia, of course, the north is the tropics, and the further south you go, the cooler it gets. The available population of Australia in East Coast region is only 6 million, and the troops left there are not a great number. Now the Australian government is calling up every man who can fight, married or unmarried, from middle age down, to try to prevent landings upon the 3,000-mile-long Australian coastline. It's an almost impossible job, and we may expect that the battle for Australia, if the Japanese choose to push it, will become a business of Japanese sallies onto the Australian coast and then counterblasts by aircraft to destroy Japanese landing heads. This is about all that can be done about it until a huge land force is available for garrisoning the long coast. Such a force could only come from the United States, and provisioning and supply in the vast stretch of wild and desert country is a task of the first magnitude. The point of Japan's game in invading Australia would be to divert Australian troops from regions to the west and to divert American fleet strength and divert American men to the protection of Australia. In addition, of course, to upset Australian morale and bring about a British cabinet crisis. Also, a good deal of fighter air strength would have to be held for the protection of the great industrial centers of Melbourne and Sydney, which comprise one-third of the population of Australia. However, it takes transport accommodations and naval and air protection in addition to men to put invaders on an alien shore, as well as to keep them off. Thus, a real Japanese invasion of Australia would become a contest in supplies of ships and airplanes, and it is very doubtful if the Japanese have sufficient reserves of these for a full-out campaign. Therefore, the eighth week of the war is more likely to see the threat to East Australia turn into a feint rather than an actual invasion. The Japs may gain the net result of establishing air bases in the tail of New Hebrides, from which they can bomb shipping passing through the Coral Sea and Torres Strait between Australia and New Hebrides, forcing our transports to go around the south of Australia, adding 2,000 miles to our sea route to Burma. The eighth week of the war may see the Japanese land at the rear of General MacArthur's lines and the prosecution of an attempt, regardless of cost, to cut him off from Corregidor, his base of information, of supply and ammunition. Southward from the Philippines, in Macassar Strait, the Dutch have mustered sufficient aircraft to play the devil with the Japanese attempt to cut the island chain in two and reach the northwestern coast of Australia. The eighth week of the war will decide if Japan is to be stymied by a superior air force at the Johor Creek, saving Singapore Island for the Allies, or whether the Japanese air superiority will carry the Japanese push through the Singapore base. Now for the overall picture at the beginning of the eighth week of war. It is this. There is every indication that the Japanese air and naval force has exhibited the peak of its strength and is rapidly being balanced by tremendous supplies and trained personnel pouring in from American, Chinese, and British sources. In the American-Chinese air attack upon the Japanese base at Hanoi in Indochina, so the Chinese news service tells us, Japanese planes were knocked out of the air so fast that Annamite rice farmers abandoned their rice planting to become junk pickers. This rain of junk from the heavens might go down as the turning point of the war in the Pacific. We are told that this sally was made by 57 planes, 27 of them bombers and 30 fighters, half of them flown by the American Volunteer Group, and half manned and piloted by Chinese bombardiers and aviators. Warlord Tojo, in his speech of yesterday to the Japanese Parliament, called the Hanoi raid just a gesture. But you know, it may be one of those gestures that indicate when the other side is taking over the argument. And so from this vantage point at San Francisco, I begin to have the feeling that we have now begun to fight.
You have been listening to This Week of War, an NBC presentation reviewing and summarizing another 7 days of hostilities on the battlefronts of the world. Heard on today's program were Earl Godwin and William Hillman, who spoke from Washington, Robert St. John in London, England, and Upton Close speaking from San Francisco. This is the Red Network of the National Broadcasting Company.